And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Real excited about today's show, a show of two Davids. Actually, we're starting out for the first 25 minutes with screenwriter David O'Leary. We're going to be talking about his creation, Project Blue Book. It's going to be airing on the History Channel starting January 8th. I'm real excited about that. And then for the remainder of the show, we have David Marler. First, we're going to talk about actually Project Blue Book files and other many documents and UFO-related memorabilia that he is preserving in his library, and it has a perpetuity future. We're going to be talking all about that. And the last part of the show, we'll be taking calls starting in hour two, and let's get started. All right, I'm here with David O'Leary. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Really excited about what you got going on here, Project Blue Book. And I have a bunch of questions to ask you. First of all, can you tell the audience when it's releasing?
Yes. January 8th at 10 p.m., 9 Central on History. Please tune in.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of us doing that. I'm really, okay. Really, really excited. And you have there's a great cast. It's Aiden, I believe it is.
That's right. We have Aiden Gillen from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
We have Michael Mullarkey, who fans may remember from Vampire Diaries. We have, so many people. Laura Manel, wonderful Laura Manel, just seen on Man in High Castle. We got Neil McDonough, people will know from Legends of Tomorrow, and Michael Harney from Orange is the New Black and Ksenia Solo. It's just a great sort of core cast. They're wonderful actors and wonderful people too, which is, I think, can be rare sometimes in this business.
That's right. And, I've watched the trailers. I've watched as much as I can watch, and I'm fascinated, and I can tell it's really great acting too and really great special effects. And so, first of all, though, I wanted to talk a little bit about you and your background, if you wouldn't mind giving that. And, you know, did you have a fascination with this topic?
I have, yeah. So I grew up in New York City, my friends and family joke, who know me best, that I have somehow found a way to kind of make a living in off of a lifelong obsession. This subject goes all the way back for me. I mean, really, as long as I can remember, I've like been fascinated with this. I grew up in New York City. I remember seeing E.T. in theaters and putting Reese's Pieces on my windowsill. I dragged my father when I was 9 years old to the movie adaptation of Whitley Strieber's Communion, starring Christopher Walken, which is a famous 1987 alien abduction book. Dragging my dad to be like, I need to go see this, and I was only 9 years old at the time.
Wow.
And it scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And all through high school, reading the books, reading everything I could get my hands on, watching documentaries on Fox, greatest UFOs ever caught on tape. And then it was really only in my adulthood, in my 20s, that I started to look much more seriously at about the history, sort of America's bizarre history with this phenomena as well, which was just as fascinating as what's going on now. And it's sort of a necessary piece for people, for anyone who's genuinely interested in this subject matter, to, I think, fully understand just how many decades this has been going on, just how far reaching it goes, and just how seriously at one point, we admitted to really taking it. I think we still take it incredibly seriously. I think we just don't admit that. And I'm talking sort of officially, sort of governmentally. That sort of became the origin for me of when I wanted to develop a TV series. And I was working more in movies at the time. as a writer, but when I wanted to get into television, I was like, this is a show I would want to see, a show based off of a real life, you know, U.S. Air Force program investigating UFOs, told through the eyes of a man who really was involved in the program, who really was a civilian astrophysicist, UFO skeptic, who over the course of his time working at Project Blue Book became convinced of a UFO reality and felt UFOs were worthy of scientific study. I just felt that and devoted the rest of his life to doing just that. So that sort of was the origin for me.
Interesting. So you're talking about J. Allen Hynek, and on YouTube, I have that video, a picture of him up now, and his little cameo there in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes. He had a wonderful cameo, and then of course was also a scientific advisor for Spielberg for the movie, right?
Right.
Which I thought was great, just in terms of kind of his continuance in being a scientist assigned to this subject.
Now, what inspired the? Let me ask you this: how did you come up with this particular idea of going and using the files and taking the cases? How did that all come about?
Yeah, I mean, that came from the fact that I had by the time I was already thinking about this idea, I had read, I'd read The UFO Experience written by Dr. Allen Hynek. He's written a couple different books. I'd read that. I'd also read Captain Ed Ruppelt's book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. So I just felt that, I think it really just came from like I was trying to figure out, I think the best writing happens when you on the writing side, if you're a film or TV writer, when you write about a subject matter that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
But also in television, it is so important. They always talk about this in Hollywood or in Los Angeles. Like, you need to have an engine of your series. You need to have, like, every week there's going to be – what's going to be the engine that you can kind of spin, that you can spin out and develop as time goes on. And for me, it was, my gosh, the entire embodiment of these – 12 of these cases, of these real life cases, where every week we could look at a real life case through the eyes of, like, basically the first director of Project Blue Book and the chief scientific advisor to Project Blue Book teamed up working together to try to solve these cases. It just felt like, okay, there, now we have our engine. Now we have a unique sort of way in into the show. But then of course it's like, you write it and you develop it, and you come up with a lot of it there too, as you find it. You know,
are you able to talk about some of the cases that will be on season one?
I am, absolutely. Me personally, I'm always a little like, I don't want to give too much away, like down the line, like some of the cases we explore in the later seasons. But certainly, anything that we've shown in the trailer is fair game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you want me to just like
tell you
a few of the cases?
Sure.
And I'll do them out of order just so we don't I don't want to give too much away. I don't want people to have too clear of a map. And again, this is more just about – ideally for me, it would be like everyone would tune in without having seen anything. But I also know that marketing is – by the way, our marketing team is wonderful, but it's like it's such a huge piece because you have to draw in that audience to even get them to understand that it exists or to watch it. But one of the cases we look at is the Lubbock Lights case, a seminal case where a mysterious V-shaped craft was seen by multiple witnesses. There are photographs. These were trained witnesses in some cases. These were professors. There was college students who saw it. So that was a case. That's a case that comes up in Ed Ruppelt's book. We explore that. We look at the Gorman incident, which was a real life. I'm blanking on the area of the Air Force that he worked for. But he was a real life military pilot who mm-hmm. basically claimed to have a dogfight with a mysterious orb of light that he couldn't explain. Working for the Coast Guard. It's escaping me. Apologize. We look at the Flatwoods Monster case, which was a multiple sighting cases witnessed by civilians, including a woman who owned a farm and multiple children. Some very strange things happening there.
Very strange. We could just if we hold on that case just a second. That is sure. Such a bizarre case.
I love that case. It's funny. I was just asked recently what's like, you know, does any of the cases stand out for you? And they listen, I love them all, and there's so many great ones. I love that case for so many reasons, just because A, there's so many different – for those who are unfamiliar with the case, it's basically like a woman and a bunch of children saw a mysterious thing crash down from the sky. And when they went to investigate, they found, you know, there was this strange mist that caused burn marks on their skin. And then, of course, more intriguingly is they all witnessed a very, very strangely depicted entity of some sort that they all said they saw the exact same thing. They were able to replicate each other's drawings about this thing. And it was this massive sort of like 10-foot creature that became known as the Flatwoods Monster. You know, this was a highly investigated case. Many witnesses who saw, you know, Army and Air Force people on the ground, they quarantined off the area. It was taken far more seriously than I think certain people might realize, because it was just a woman working on a farm and a group of children of varying ages that saw it. But what's great about that case is there's a high strangeness to it. If you ever go online and even Google the Flatwoods Monster drawings and stuff like that, it just looks so strange, and the depiction of it is so bizarre that I think it reflects just how weird sometimes this phenomenon, like so weird it has to be true, like just so
I agree.
It's not just, you know what I mean, and a lot of these cases have that, like the level of detail where it's just like, that's just strange. That's like, that's not something you read in a sci-fi comic,
right?
That's like something that, like, unless like that, like you should be a sci-fi comic writer if you have this incredible imagination, or you're just telling me something that like almost makes no sense, that is just so weird. And yeah, so I always loved that case. But we look at a, you know, I think when we were picking out what cases we wanted to do, we also wanted to make sure we were truthful to the sort of various forms in which UFO phenomena occurs. I think most people, when they think of a UFO, they think of the classic, like, oh, like a man sees a disc, metallic disc hovering in the sky. But there's so much more strange types of UFOs that people see that go all the way back, and we've tried to be as authentic and honest to that as we could. And there are frankly cases that we didn't get to in that you know, we were trying to be as truthful to chronologically as we could within a certain window, and there's some great cases that we just like were unable to get to. We had 10 episodes that I would love to, you know, if we get the chance to continue to tell stories, explore some of these other ones that are just, you know, that are crazy.
The Socorro case, have you heard of that?
I have. That case took place, if I believe, I think it's 66, and we tried to keep our window. We did try to keep our window. You know, I would say that the timeline of the show unfolds between about, you know, let's just say like 1951 through 1952, and I would say that the breadth of cases we look at go from about 1948 to 1953. And so we tried to be – it's tricky because, you know, you want to – you're building a compelling, you know, drama, and you want your cases to feel like they build and connect and also help kind of tell the story you want to tell that's happening on the ground as well, and sort of become more and more apparently you know, grow in stature and in sort of multiple witnesses and things like that as they go on. So we tried to be, you know – but I love that case. I mean, I do love that case. We were, you know, we had certain rules of like, oh, if that case was too far ahead, we're like, we love it, but we can't do it. Can we find a case that like does that? And then there were some great ones that like we were gonna do, and then we found something better, or you know what I mean, that we would still want to do. But it's a wonderful case, and one of the seminal cases, actually, by the way, for Hynek, that was that kind of stuck with him.
Right.
So that's the case. I mean, for sure, I'd love to get there. You know what I mean? And I'd love to get there in and around the timeline of our show when it really happened.
Are you going to be exploring at all the time when there was sort of like a time when Hynek all of a sudden starts to realize, wow, you know, there really is something to this? Is that going to be?
Yes. Like, because here's the truth about Hynek. Hynek for the public eye emerges a. You know, goes in a skeptic, and then in 1969 pops out a believer, right? Or pops out having shifted sides, being thinking that these cases are worthy of scientific study. But the truth is that arc happened while working at Blue Book. I've seen interviews where it's like as early as the CIA Robertson panel in 1953, he already was well aware, okay, Project Blue Book is in many ways a disinformation, a PR campaign for the Air Force and using people like myself to go out there and explain away sightings. That's weird, because if they're trying to use us to explain something away, what are they explaining away? Top secret military aircraft? Is that all this is? So his arc of, you know, he was a man that always stuck to his guns of being driven. What drives him is science, you know, and the scientific pursuit and the evidence. And, you know, I think it's the totality of his time at Blue Book that had him devote the rest of his life to pursuing UFOs was, you know, seriously. But his, you know, just having, you know, from the things I've read and the multiple people I've talked to, that journey of realizing there was far more here than meets the eye began during his time at Blue Book. And we certainly look at that. And one of the reasons, you know, and even though that Blue Book was in many ways a, you know, sort of the beginnings of fake news, if you want to look at it through that regard, you know, that window, you know, he was a principled scientist, but he had to play some ball on that issue because he wanted to stay. Like, why not leave Blue Book? And it's because of his access to the cases. You know what I mean? Like, as a scientist, he couldn't turn away. He knew that if I stay and I do the job I'm hired here to do, I maintain my access. And that became a big piece of why he stayed on for many, many years. And so for sure, we explore that as well. But I think most importantly, we try to stay true to a man who is driven by science, even though while others he's partnered with, like Michael Mullarky's character, who plays Captain Michael Quinn, you know, are driven more by a sense of military duty and patriotism. And like, listen, this is our job. Our job is to go out there and you know, we're trying to avoid hysteria here. We're trying to avoid, you know, chaos and feeding fuel to paranoia that we frankly don't know is warranted. You know, we need to close cases. And so it becomes this very interesting dynamic for the two of them of Hynek being driven by science and Michael Mullarky's character, Michael Quinn, being driven by military sense of purpose and duty and all that kind of thing.
You've seen, I'm sure you've seen the clip when he talks about swamp gas, right?
Oh, for sure. And one of the cases Hynek regrets so deeply, yes, right? It's having to be like, yeah, for those listeners unfamiliar, right? This was like also in the late 60s, maybe 66 as well, or near that time where like, yeah, they were seeing these mysterious lights, right, over like kind of the swampy marshes of was it Michigan? And like and he gets forced to go on and basically say, yes, what you're seeing is swamp gas. And so we explore stuff like that as well. It's not an easy job when, as a scientist, you're being told to deny your scientific vigor and scientific mind in order to do what can be argued to be, at least then, by some, a greater good of calming public and having people turn away while people are exploring, you know, the military and everybody else is exploring the genuineness of what's really happening.
Right.
You know?
Right. Now, you mentioned kind of the guideline for picking cases is like a time error. But do you actually do this with someone? Is this something you do alone? I think I heard you say that we. So does that mean you have like a team of people going through these cases and choosing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when the show got picked up to series, so I wrote the pilot episode and I put together what's called the Bible, which sort of mapped out the show itself, season one, and then even the series beyond that. But when it gets picked up to series, you know, I didn't write every episode. We brought in a showrunner, somebody who is like a veteran in television. I had been working as a writer, but this was the first time for me working in TV. And TV is so much that goes into making a television show. My goodness,
I bet.
And we brought in this wonderful showrunner who is just as passionate about this issue as I am, named Sean Jablonski. And him and I, you know, I gave him everything I had. Basically, him and I sat in a room for a month before we even opened up the writer's room, which was a small room of about five writers where we really mapped out the season, where him and I just went through and I just kind of laid it all out on the table. Like, here's what I want to do. Here are the cases I think we should explore. He read all the, he had, you know, went in and read all the research, all the books I had read. And then him and I just sort of built it out together. And, And but what was great was, you know, he all the cases I wanted to do, he wanted to do. And we were very in sync about what we thought was interesting and what we thought would be dynamic enough to so that every week people are looking at some of the best seminal cases of that era. And then we partnered up with some great writers. It was a small room. It was just myself, our showrunner, two other kind of veteran TV writers, and then a young staff writer. She was great too. And we, you know, we mapped it out and worked with our network and studio and cast and everybody to make sure we were telling the best version of the story that we could.
How difficult was it to pitch this? Was it a real tough one, or did it go fairly easy?
Well, it's funny. So when I sold the project initially, I had done something that's less common in television, which is I wrote the pilot script. I wrote a script and I wrote a Bible before with nobody paying me to do it. I was just like, this is the show here's a show I would want to do. And my hope was like, and I was working on a couple of things at the time, and my hope was like, listen, maybe there's someone out there who is going to spark to this show and want to do it the way I want to do it. Or at the very least, like, you know, people at least, you know, get taken on a great ride and maybe want to meet with me for other projects and things like that. Because that's sort of how television works, is like, you know, you never know if what you're writing is going to be a sample or a show. But fortunately, we were able to get it in the hands of History and A&E Studios. And once they bought it, we did eventually, what happened was, when it was getting time when History was going to decide, okay, what show are we going to make next? You know, they had entered the scripted arena. They had done a show called Six, which is a great military drama show. They did two seasons of that based on real life SEAL Team Six missions. They have a show called Nightfall, which is about sort of the Knights of the Round Table or the Templar or all that. When they came to us about the show, they asked that I sort of reverse engineer a pitch that could really help everybody involved who greenlights a show. You know, even though they had read the script and looked at the Bible and all and do all that, understand what the series would be. And that was a joy. I mean, I actually really had a great time kind of building that out as a pitch that I had to basically memorize and give. And then I put together some visual stuff as well for that as well. I cut what's called like a rip-a-matic trailer, where you're basically, you know, incorporating images from other shows and things like that and movies and stuff like that to help just paint a picture of like, here's the look and feel of what this could be. And I think that that can sometimes help you as well, having sort of visual aids. But you know, when you got Bob Zemeckis in the room, that helps too.
We only have about a minute or so here. But what did it feel like when you got the news that the History Channel picked it up? You must have been beside yourself.
I was beside myself. I was absolutely beside myself. I'll tell that story, which was basically, I happened to be in New York City at the time. It was right before Memorial Day weekend last year. This is 2017. I'm out to dinner with my family, and I knew that we were supposed to be hearing by then. And I go outside, and it's an assistant on the phone being like, "Hey, David, I have," and then she lists everybody involved in the show for you. And I was like, okay. And I was standing on like 110th and Broadway, like where I, you know, grew up, like my stomping grounds. And Arturo, our network executive, said, you know, History has decided to move forward with Project Blue Book. We're going straight to series with 10 episodes. Congratulations.
Oh my God.
And wow. It was just like one of those moments, you know, I'll never forget, because for me, it's like, listen, as a writer, it was a massive success as a career move, of course. Like, I had been, you know what I mean? They say like success is 10 years in the making. And I had been, you know, near misses and banging down doors and just trying to get my stuff. You know, any writer will attest just how difficult it is. So it felt really good to get a yes, but it really felt good to get a yes to a show that I was already to, like, this was the thing I wanted them to say yes to. Do you know what I mean? Like, I had other things going on, other, you know, comic book thing I'd work on or whatever. But this one was like the one for me. And so to get the yes to the one for me was just like a dream. It's a dream come true. And then it just became about, okay, let's pour all that passion into trying to make as good a television series as we possibly can.
Excellent.
That's what we're hoping to do. And that's what I'm really excited about, you know, getting folks to watch it, you know, is just, I can't wait to hear what the response will be. And I genuinely hope people like it, you know.
I have a feeling they're going to, and I wish you many seasons.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's the true hope. I mean, please, you know, when people watch it, if you like it, tell your friends about it. You know what I mean? It's a competitive marketplace out there. And, you know, there's so many more stories we want to tell with this show and, you know, and kind of track all the stuff that's happening now, too. And it's just,
right.
You know, it's incredible what's going on now within the current UFO climate. So there's just a lot happening here.
Excellent. All right. Yeah. David O'Leary, thank you so much. And we'll be looking for January 8th.
January 8th on History. Thank you.
Yeah. Shut off. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you? I'm doing well. Thank you.
Yeah. That was not a very gentle fade I just did there. Always love to have you on the show, Dave. Thanks for being willing to come back. And
sure.
Want to cover a lot of subjects. Did you listen to our last guest?
I did. And I was just sitting here thinking to myself right before we transitioned over, if any of your audience wasn't interested in this TV series after hearing David O'Leary speak, he has a contagious enthusiasm that just spills over. And if you weren't interested in watching the show before after hearing him, I think you'd be a fool not to watch it. I mean, it sounds like it's really going to be a roller coaster ride of enjoyment as far as touching on the history, as he mentioned, but also creating that entertainment aspect, you know, surrounding the history.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. And, I've watched just trailers so far, but I know Alejandro has been able to actually see the first clip. They had the screening that he got to see and all that. So, right. Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to it. So just real quickly, for the person that's not familiar with who you are and your research library and all that, can you just kind of give a nutshell?
Yeah, I've been actively involved in UFOs since 1990. During that time, I did field investigations for MUFON in the early years, then branched off and started doing historical research and collecting and gathering a lot of historical materials and making those readily available to researchers, film producers, and other interested parties. And as a result, I've done a lot of lecturing across the country and participated in many different documentary TV series and TV shows on the subject. So do a lot of lecturing. I've lectured at the university level here at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, and really just trying to educate people on the real history, if you will, regarding the subject. And as you and I have discussed on many occasions, there's such a rich history, and even David O'Leary, your previous guest, touched on that. There's a diverse, rich history that most people really aren't aware of. Even those that go to UFO conferences, I really don't think they've done their due diligence in really looking at the historical narrative, not just here in the United States, but obviously on a global level, looking at other countries and other governments that have researched the subject.
Would you think that there's probably a rich history that we're unaware of? You know, like in perhaps colonial times, or, you know, just throwing a number going back, you know, 500 years or 1,000 years or whatever. Do you think there's a history? You know, you hear little blurbs and some of them are, you know, turn out not to be true. But what do you think?
Exactly.
About all that? Yeah.
Well, that's one of the biggest questions I get, whether it's talking to someone from the general public or at a UFO conference. How far does this UFO subject go back? Obviously, you know, back in the 70s when I was growing up, they used to call them the ancient astronauts. Now they call it ancient aliens. But the concept is the same in the sense that did early civilizations encounter some type of, let's just say, non-human intelligence that interacted with us early in our development? It's interesting. It's food for thought. It's speculative at best. Obviously, going back that far, you're reading religious narratives that can be filtered through religious belief. So is it really factual in the sense that, you know, let's say in comparison to military investigations where they actually went out and interviewed the witness and they're putting quotations, you know, under these statements or around these statements that witnesses have made. So it's interesting to delve back further in history, but the further you go back, the more difficult it is to really verify or, you know, confirm, you know, quote unquote facts. Much of the narratives are in religious writings, which are, like I said, filtered and veiled through cultural ideas and beliefs from that time. So it's really hard to separate the wheat from the chaff.
And then you get into Native American, for instance, and their oral history, which is actually really fascinating. You know,
it is. I've actually had some interesting discussions with some Native Americans here in New Mexico that have either come to my lectures or I've just met socially, and some of the interesting discussions with that. And even John Alexander, who wrote the foreword to my book, he and I have had some interesting discussions. And one of the things John always brings up, which I think is an important point, is Western civilization, Western mindset, we have normal and we have paranormal, and there's a solid line dividing the two. And as John has pointed out in some of his lectures that I've attended, with the Native Americans and many other indigenous populations across the world, there's not a division. Rather, it's a continuum. And so there is no stark division between the two. They view it all as part of reality, just different areas along the spectrum of reality, which I think is kind of an interesting concept.
Right, right. So since we were just left with David O'Leary and talking about Project Blue Book, you have some of Rob Mercer's files. Rob's been on the show a while back.
Yes.
For the person that's unfamiliar with those important files, I think they're important, and I'm sure you do too. Can you tell how all that happened?
Absolutely. I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version. And when I tell people this story, they're almost in disbelief. But I think it illustrates that you just simply never know where this material or this information is going to turn up. I'll try to keep it brief for your audience because I know we have a lot of other things we want to cover. About 3 to 4 years ago, Rob Mercer in Springfield, Ohio, was relatively new to the UFO subject. He was a relatively new member of MUFON, and he was surfing the internet on eBay, Craigslist, looking for just all manner of UFO information. I think when we all get into this, we're all trying to learn as much as we can, and we're trying to just soak up information like a sponge. And one of the many searches on the internet, he stumbled across someone on Craigslist in the Dayton, Ohio area that was purportedly selling original Project Blue Book material. And like myself, Rob thought that's just simply too good to be true. Well, it was in the Dayton area, which of course is where Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was, Air Technical Intelligence Center, where Project Blue Book was based out of. So it was in at least the right area. Long story short, I mean, the curiosity got the best of him, and he decided, I'm going to at least pursue this and see what all this is about. Met with the individual, and the individual that he purchased this material from, like many people, they go out and bid on these storage units that go into arrears on their rental fees. Mm-hmm. And so they open up the door to this one storage unit, and this individual saw all this lumber, and he was in the construction, and he thought, well, I'll just bid on this for the lumber. He won the bid, starts hauling all the lumber out, and all the way to the far back end of the storage unit are 2 to 3 boxes marked Project Blue Book. He opens it up and immediately realizes it has to do with UFOs, and this may be a shock to many of your audience, but he had no interest in UFOs whatsoever. And so he threw it on Craigslist, and the timing worked out to where Rob was able to reach out to him, met with him, saw the information, and purchased the collection. And over the ensuing months, and I think year to year and a half, started going through the material, and one name kept popping up in some of the interoffice memorandums that were in the collection, and it involved a gentleman by the name of Lieutenant Carmen Morano, and obviously not a common name like John Smith. So Rob, in his infinite wisdom, decided I'm going to go on the internet and try to look at, see if this guy's still around. And tracked Rob, actually tracked him down. Rob tracked down Lieutenant Carmen Morano and struck up a conversation by phone. And over a series of successive phone calls, developed a rapport with him. And in one of the subsequent conversations, Lieutenant Morano actually stated, you know, Rob, you seem like you're having an enjoyable time with that material. He goes, I think I might have two or three more boxes of that material here at my home. And so he wound up getting more material in addition to what he originally collected. And over about 3 years, Rob took the time to digitally scan and transfer all of this material so it's preserved digitally. The documents, the photographs, the film footage, audio recordings. It was just literally a treasure trove, a historical time capsule of Project Blue Book from the late 50s to the termination of the project in 69. And in fact, Carmen Morano was one of the last staff members. For if your audience Googles Project Blue Book staff, they can actually see a picture of Lieutenant Carmen Morano from that time period.
Yeah, we actually had we had his picture up just now on YouTube.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So it was just amazing that he took all this material with him. And for any friends that are in the DOD, all its information is unclassified. There's nothing classified in nature. Always like to throw that out just for the record. But in fact, I was listening to David O'Leary talk about Blue Book. Here's some of the original Project Blue Book files right here.
Oh, wow.
We have a lot of interesting documentation. These are actually on cases from New Mexico involving White Sands Missile Range, UFO sightings around White Sands Missile Range in 1957. And then talking about Socorro, these are some of the original Socorro black and white photographs.
Wow.
From the landing site, from Project Blue Book. And it has the proper earmarks. Not sure if you can see, but this says Foreign Technology Division right there on the top of the mm-hmm. photographs. And then we also have unclassified right here. And then in addition to that, we have the Tremonton, Utah footage, famous film footage, 16 millimeter.
And have you actually been able to watch that?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the really nice things was this little box right here. I have two or three of these. These were inner office briefings for Project Blue Book staff members and Air Force personnel, quoting the latest sighting statistics. And what's interesting is on these slides in the corner, you'll see the Foreign Technology Division logo. So these were actually interoffice briefings done for Project Blue Book staff. And so just a few of the things. And then you also mentioned Socorro. I quickly grabbed the unredacted Socorro 1964 landing trace case from April 24th, 1964. And this is the original Project Blue Book report right here.
Wow.
So just some really neat original pieces of material that I know the University of New Mexico is interested in eventually having in their library for long-term preservation.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because first of all, we're going to pull up, for the people watching YouTube, we're going to pull up an image of your library, your research library.
Oh, okay,
perfect. We have a couple of those up there. So let's talk about what you have been doing to preserve these documents and gather these documents. I mean, you've laid out a lot of your own expense over the years to actually, you even built a place onto your home, didn't you? Did you build a?
Yes. There's a 20 foot by, I'm actually sitting in it as we speak, 20 by 22 foot room. I'm surrounded by, 75 plus years of UFO history from floor to ceiling, wall to wall. I'm looking at about 16 four-drawer file cabinets full of historical material on one side, bookcases on the other, original front-page newspapers and photographs on the walls. A year ago, decided to do the collection, properly and have a dedicated room built specifically to house this material, but also to afford the ability for individuals that are coming through Albuquerque that are interested in the subject to come and review the material. A lot of people are interested in doing research, but they don't know where to go to get the information. And as I think you and I have discussed before, there's a plethora of UFO information on the internet, but how much is actually factually accurate or true? Mm-hmm. And this affords individuals that are interested in doing serious, and I underscore that three times, serious UFO research by coming here, looking and actually holding the original newspapers from the 1950s, holding the original government documents, looking at some of the original materials. One other example I pulled while we were I was listening to the first part, you were talking about the Flatwoods Monster case. This is a little curio I picked up. This is handwritten testimony by the original adult witness, Miss Kathleen May, it's in her own handwriting. So this is an actual contemporaneous report of the Flatwoods Monster case, handwritten account by Miss Kathleen May, dated November 22nd, 1953. And then there's some subsequent notes on the other page as well. So just one example. Amazing. But in the years that I've been involved in the subject, obviously, as you mentioned, I've spent a lot of money purchasing, collecting, housing this material. The one thing I always like to mention, though, you know, people talk about the Bible. Well, the Bible means a book of books. This is a collection of collections. Many of these items were acquired through previous researchers that I've known or that have since passed on, Lou Farish being one, Bill Pitts being another one, Antonio Huneas. I just recently acquired the files from Antonio Huneas earlier this year, Dr. Leon Davidson, Mr. David Schroth from St. Louis, Missouri, who collected a lot of historical material in the 60s. So it is truly a collection of collections in that sense. But I felt that it was important not only for what I've personally expended in time and money in collecting this material, but also I owe it to these individuals that entrusted me with their collections to try to ensure when I shuffle off this mortal coil that this material is going to be preserved for future researchers and historians. So to that end, I approached the University of New Mexico about 2 or 3 years ago and told them about my collection. Now, you can imagine going to a university, going in talking UFOs. I expected them to quickly shuffle me out the door. But I did my homework. I literally put together a PowerPoint presentation to go in and quote unquote sell them on the idea that at the end of the day, and I always tell my audiences this, whether you relegate the subject to fact, fiction, or folklore, at the end of the day, it's part of history. And I think David O'Leary even touched on that during the first half of the show. And so because it's part of history, it's incumbent upon us to preserve that history for future historians and future researchers. And they agreed. And last year, not only did they, you know, agree to having this as part of their Southwest Special Collections Library, but they also invited me to speak at their annual event. So I was able to talk about the UFO subject at a university level to the general public, students, and members of the academic community there. And it was very, very well received. In fact, we did a lecture. We see the nature and scope of the historical material that I've collected. So it was very well attended. We had a nice little wine and cheese social right beforehand. They did it right. And I'm just happy to say the staff at the University of New Mexico has been absolutely outstanding to work with. And they've helped facilitate some of my historical research by helping me go through their microfilm collection, going through old newspaper archives. And it's just been an absolute pleasure to work with each and every one of them. I couldn't have imagined the reception that they gave me. And anytime I go to the university, they roll out the red carpet. They treat me like royalty. And the Dean Richard Clement of Library Sciences, I consider him a good friend at this point. And he and his wife have been here in this room to review the materials. And they just find it utterly fascinating, as I think most people do when they take the time to really look at the data.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. And it's so great because this is, you know, it's going to be preserved where actually people can actually continue their research. And like, for instance, right now, if someone wants to do research and they're traveling through Albuquerque, they just get in touch with you and ahead of time.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, as long as they give me notice, I do work for a living. So yeah. I'm not here continuously, although I wish I could be to go through the material. But as long as they give me about a month's notice, I could probably make sure I try to coordinate something for them. But like I said, we've had a lot of film crews in here just since this was erected. James Fox, obviously, I was on a segment previously with James Fox, and James was here for 2 to 3 days, and he was literally like a kid in a candy store. When he first came in, he started going through and he just started randomly just pulling out things, and he was excited like a kid on Christmas opening presents. And David White, the cameraman, he and I just kept looking at each other and laughing because James didn't realize how much material I had. And I'm happy to say it's going to be a major part of his documentary coming up next year. And I was gratified that he didn't waste a trip coming out here. In fact, just going back to the Socorro photographs, he actually went to the National Archives with researcher Ray Stanford and was desperately trying to find clear photographs of the landing site. And he called me before he had come out for his visit. And he said, Dave, he goes, I was really disappointed. He goes, I went to the National Archives and he goes, they had photos from Project Blue Book on the Socorro landing site. But he goes, you couldn't make them out. They were almost illegible. And I said, well, you know the history of how those images got there. He goes, no, tell me. I said, well, at the termination of Project Blue Book in December 69, those files were sent to Maxwell Air Force Base, where I was on a research trip earlier this year. And they were redacted and microfilmed and made available to the general public. Later in years, those microfilm images were then digitally scanned, and then they're there at the National Archives. And he goes, well, he goes, the images I saw, he goes, they were illegible. And I said, well, that's why. It's like making a copy of a copy of a copy. And he goes, naively, he asked me, do you have anything on Socorro? And I said, James, I hope you're sitting down. He goes, why? I said, I have original photographs from Project Blue Book of the Socorro landing site. And he goes, you're kidding me. He goes, are they clear? I said, I'm looking at them right now. I said, it looks like they were developed yesterday. And so long story short, he was able to get those photographs for use for his upcoming documentary.
Yeah, we're all pretty excited about that. I can't wait for that to come out.
For anybody that saw Out of the Blue, I've already seen some preliminary clips. For anybody that saw Out of the Blue and you liked Out of the Blue, that's just an appetizer for what's to come.
Yeah, and that's, to me, that's the best UFO film out there.
So, I that's what I tell people. If they ask for a documentary, I said, you need to see Out of the Blue.
Yep. Great. Wow. So just real quickly, you are actually doing a little bit of a fund drive to help you procure and carry on. Do you want to talk about that real quickly and how people can find that and help you out?
Yes, actually, this just came about over, and I think I told you on the phone a week or so ago, I was actually visiting my mother and family and friends in St. Louis, Missouri, and a friend that actually wrote the back cover description that I use for the back of my book. He had mentioned the fact that, well, you're working with University of New Mexico, all this material is going to go there. He goes, you know, they as a library are always looking to solicit funds and donations. He goes, have you ever thought about doing the same thing? He goes, you have your own research library. He goes, rather than you funding out of pocket, he goes, I'm sure there's people out there that might be willing and able to financially assist you with that. So after kind of ruminating over the idea, I decided, why not? I'll throw the net out there and see if we can garner any funds to kind of help, not with what's here now, but obviously there are always new collections coming up. There's researchers that are unfortunately passing away, and the relatives are either donating, but typically selling, unfortunately, their materials. So when those collections come up, I thought it would be nice if we could start developing a fund to have that material or have that money there for when these materials become available. And if I can't personally afford it, we can utilize those funds to secure and preserve those collections. So that's what I did. I kind of threw that out there. And so I started a GoFundMe site to try to generate funds for the acquisition and preservation of future collections as they become available.
Well, you know, it's very much like I do a lot of work with museums, and they have benefactors. You know, basically people waiting in the wings with funds if, you know, like a Van Gogh painting comes up or something, you know, and they. So it's very similar.
And just like that, you have to seize the opportunity. These are once in a lifetime opportunities, much like the Project Blue Book material that surfaced. It's not going to happen again. So, you know, you hope you have the funds at the time that these collections become available. So, we're going to try it. It's an experiment. It's going to be a long-term experiment. There's no deadline. So the GoFundMe site will be there for future months and years. And I just hope we can continually build up the funding. And then when these collections do become available, we will hopefully be able to provide not just money for the purchase, the acquisition, but obviously, as you and I have talked about with some of these collections, I've had to pay to fly out and I've had to pay to rent a U-Haul truck and then drive it back. So, you know, there's a lot that goes on in the background. These materials just don't magically manifest themselves. There's a lot of work and time involved. Right. And so And to that point, too, I often will ask for volunteers if people are interested in coming and assisting and doing the research. It's not just the money, but it's the time and the labor that's involved. And I'm very fortunate to have a group of retired individuals that are interested in the subject that live within about 5 to 6 miles of myself. And on a regular basis, they come over and help with the scanning, the digitization, the cataloging of the collection for the eventual donation to the University of New Mexico. So there's a lot going on here in this little 20 by 22 foot room. But on a busy day, we're all scanning and filing and categorizing material. But as I've often said, people always joke about my obsessive compulsive nature as far as organization. But when you, in all seriousness, when you have this much material, if it's not organized, there's no point in having it. Because if you ask for a specific material on a given case, I need to be able to readily retrieve it. You don't have time to go through 16 four-drawer file cabinets. So it is incumbent upon myself to make sure that this material is not only here, but organized.
Now, when you were going through the lot that Rob Mercer brought to you,
yes,
Project Blue Book, what would you say is the most exciting part of – is there one thing that stands out to you in what you're looking through?
I would probably say – gosh, that's such a hard question to answer because, like James Fox when he was here, I was like a kid in a candy store opening these boxes and literally holding original Project Blue Book material like yourself and many others. And even David O'Leary, who you heard talking about his interest in the subject over the years, I had read about Project Blue Book. I had seen the photographs of Project Blue Book. This is the real McCoy. These are the actual files. These are the actual papers that were sitting in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And it really just, it's almost like an out-of-body experience in a sense.
Yeah.
It really takes you outside yourself. But I would probably say the Socorro case, because I was always fascinated with that case even before I moved to New Mexico. And now I only live about an hour, hour and a half away from Socorro. So, you know, I drive through Socorro on a regular basis on business trips. But to see the photographs, to see the unredacted report, and just read the newspaper accounts, because Blue Book not only did their own investigation, they scanned and copied a lot of the local newspaper articles from the time period. So I think just to have those materials from a New Mexico case, one that I read about as a kid, and like I said, here's the real deal. It's not supposition. It's not someone's interpretation. This is the original case file.
Now, I believe you and I have talked about this. I went and visited Ray Stanford. And
yes.
He showed me an image that I'm still baffled by it today, and he's not really releasing that image to the public.
I've heard reference to it.
He's very, very cautious. But I'll tell you, he took a picture of the dynamite shack just for he had a friend stand nearby just so he could get the reference of height of how big it was and all that. And as he blew that negative up, I swear to God, it's exactly an egg-shaped craft you can see in the sky. And, I mean, it's so perfect. It's just hard to believe it's an image, you know.
And I would argue that if it came through any other source, we could raise a skeptical eyebrow. But Ray Stanford, I mean, his reputation precedes him in the field. So, you know, I think anybody that knows Ray knows his work. His reputation, you know, is beyond reproach.
Right, right. And that's definitely – that one picture alone was worth the seven-hour drive for me down there and back.
Yeah, I have an open invitation, but I've been trying to find the funds and the free time to actually venture out there. But
yeah.
I hope I can maybe see that firsthand eventually myself.
It's well worth it. Really is. Yeah. All right. So this is when we normally go to break. And my guest is David Marler. And we'll be right back. Well, guess what? We're right back. And Dave, I would like for you to talk about a case that you did a lot of work on recently. I do want to talk a little bit about triangles somewhere along the line, but I know you worked on the Farmington case. Can we talk about that real quickly?
Absolutely. You know, when I finished my book, it was published in June 2013. And I wrote that when I first moved out to New Mexico. And as I often tell my friends, it was perfect timing because I moved out to New Mexico with my job and not literally not knowing a soul out here. And so I thought that the timing was perfect. I just got back from a conference and everyone assumed I had written a book on the triangular UFO phenomenon. So I wrote my book because I didn't have any distractions. There were no friends or family to distract me. And so once I got the book published, though, I thought to myself, well, what's the next project? And I always had those cases that I had read about, but I felt really had never been given their due justice from an investigative standpoint. And so now living in New Mexico, I thought, well, I go up to Farmington on business now. I should try to do some of my own research on that and track down one of the last living witnesses. He's still with us. He's 93, 94 years old now, and a very successful businessman up there. I've had multiple visits and conversations at his business as well as his home. Have interviewed him multiple times and gotten to know him. And delving in to the Farmington case actually took me to the University of Arizona in Tucson, where we talked about UNM housing a UFO collection. They have the UFO collection of Dr. James McDonald.
Wow.
And all of his case files. And it was actually Stan Friedman that had suggested I go there to see what Dr. McDonald had collected, because he thought he had gathered some material on Farmington. And no one had really shed light on his investigation. And so I was amazed to see the number of interviews that he had conducted and the testimony that he had received from some of these witnesses. Now, the case occurred the 16th, 17th, and 18th of March, 1950. Dr. James McDonald, in the mid to late 60s, began his investigations. So his interviews were about 10 to 15 years after the sightings had occurred. But as you can appreciate, many more witnesses were alive in the mid-60s as opposed to, you know, 2013, 2014, when I started doing my investigation. But in combining that information with the information I gathered through the University of New Mexico, going through old newspaper archives, and then conducting my own interview with Marlo Webb, who is the one of the last witnesses, if not the last witness that's alive, that was mentioned in the Farmington, New Mexico paper, where it says, you know, flying saucer armada jolts Farmington. He is one of the individuals mentioned by name that was interviewed. And one other addition to that, just earlier this year, I was able to get through a Freedom of Information Act request, formally classified Air Force files on their Farmington investigation. And I now have the unredacted Air Force OSI documents that reference Marlo by name, as well as another witness that we didn't have, whose name was Hulon Pace. And that was a name we didn't have previously. But now that I was able to get these documents declassified, we now have a new witness name. Based on my research, he has long since passed away. What's interesting, though, I always like to underscore this. A lot of people, there's a lot of critics out there, as we know, Martin, even within the UFO field. A lot of people like to cast stones at researchers doing good work. The one thing I like to mention, just to kind of counter some of the comments I've seen on the internet, people say, well, this happened in 1950. Why are we rehashing these old cases? Because some of these documents have only now been declassified. These files were just declassified last year, but they weren't resurrected until I filed my FOIA request. 1950 to 2017. It took that many years to get these files declassified, and only then do we get new insights, new aspects into these investigations. And so that is why, much like the Battle of L.A. that we may talk about later, these files weren't declassified. Battle of L.A. occurred in February 42. It was through the research efforts of Barry Greenwood in the late 70s and early to mid 80s before we had these documents released.
Wow.
So it's mainly because of that. When new documents, when new evidence comes forward, we have to reinvestigate, much like a murder case, a cold case. If new information comes to light, we need to go back. We need to delve back into that case and see, how does this new information correlate with what we thought we knew at the time?
I have the image related to Farmington up on YouTube. Can you describe? It's really bizarre. I mean, some of them really do look like discs. There's a whole bunch of them. I know you can't
Is that a photo?
Yeah, it's a photo of looking up, and there's a grouping of objects that look like discs, black and white photo.
Yeah. Is it a somewhat like V-shaped formation?
That's correct.
Okay. That actually I did extensive research on. Uh-oh. And I can say this with certainty. I'm the only one that's been able to really, truly delve into that with the additional assistance of Juan Vicente Ballester Olmos, a Spanish ufologist that has done his UFO catalog of cataloging UFO photos over the years. And if people go to my website, they can go to my Farmington research tab, and there's a link to a blog that he wrote on researching that photograph. And with some of the assistance that I provided, that had been purported to have been a photograph of the Farmington Armada. But based on all of my research, I think I've completely debunked it insofar as not being associated with Farmington. That's not to say it might not be a legitimate UFO photograph. And the reason I say that is I had analyzed that photograph as far as trying to delve into the history and where it originated from. And it took me all the way back to a newspaper, which, again, the audience can read about on my website. It was an Irish newspaper that apparently was only published for a year called the Teenage Times. And it took me a year and a half to track this newspaper down. One of the reasons it was so difficult, it was only published for a year, but it was never microfilmed and it was never digitized. Wow. And so I had to start going to individual libraries in Ireland where I had kind of zeroed in on where it apparently originated from, because I have an original 1950 copy of that photograph from the London Times with the news teletype glued to the back, much like the Battle of LA photo that we may talk about later. Yeah. And again, this underscores the importance of going to the original documents. I think it's very important to do that. And long story short, it was actually in the National Library in Dublin, Ireland. They had original newspaper, hard copies of the newspapers. I paid, again, here's where the money comes into play for researchers out there. I had to pay to get that newspaper digitized. They sent me the digital copies, of which I have a copy on my Farmington report. But what's interesting about that, the reason I say it was debunked, for two reasons. One, the witnesses all attest to the fact that in Farmington on those 3 days that the UFOs were sighted, it was clear skies or a light scattering of cirrus clouds. If you look at that photograph, they're cumulus clouds in the photo. So it doesn't conform to the meteorological reports and data from that time period in Farmington. Another reason, Wendell Stevens, the late Wendell Stevens, had a copy of that photograph, and on the back was written Farmington, New Mexico. And in a documentary from the 90s, he relays the story that it was sold to him by a gentleman stating that this was the Farmington UFOs and that this photograph was secreted out of Farmington before the Air Force agents swooped in and confiscated all the film and cameras. Well, I've talked to Marlo Webb, and he laughed at the idea that agents swooped in and confiscated film and cameras. In fact, he remarked, he goes, they didn't express that much interest. They simply came into town, did an interview with me, and he goes, and he even made this comment, which I thought was funny, Martin. He said, he goes, they interviewed me, but not to the scope and depth that you did. He goes, you asked way more questions than the Air Force investigators asked. He said, but they just asked a few questions, went around, and they apparently wrote a report. And but what was interesting is the story that was relayed to Wendell was that this photograph was, like I said, taken out of Farmington and later in the weeks and months to follow was published in the Durango, Colorado newspaper. Well, there's a lead that's easy to follow up on. Me and some of my research colleagues took a weekend trip up to Durango, Colorado. And there were two newspapers published back in 1950, March of 1950 in Durango. And luckily, we thought we were going to have to go through hours of microfilm. They had digitized the microfilm into PDF. So they were able to give me a year's worth of both newspaper, both before and after the Farmington sightings, which we were able to bring back to the research room here and casually review on our computers. And no photograph ever appeared in any of the newspapers. So the story that was relayed to Wendell, I think we thoroughly debunked that there was no merit to the story. I think it was a story built up to sell Wendell those photos or the photo. Yeah. And I always like to say, I don't think Wendell was dishonest or disingenuous in relaying that story, but that was the story as it was relayed to him.
Okay. Yep. Well, I had that image up there for See how that can happen?
But I think it's important. I think it's important not only to verify information, but to vet the information and determine that some information may not be legitimate. I mean, it gets us closer to the truth.
Right, right. And I always appreciate that and appreciate your work because that's your, you know, that's what you do. So anyway, the lines are open if anyone would like to call in. That number is on the screen on YouTube, and feel free to give a call if you have a question for our guest. I'd like to move on to the Battle of L.A. That's a real fascinating one because this is actually what we consider the modern UFO era.
One of the reasons I like the case so much, I always like to say it was kind of a period of innocence as far as UFOs go because we hadn't even invented the term yet. It wasn't in our mindset or our zeitgeist. So
right.
I really find it interesting, one, for that reason. But also, as I mentioned earlier, Martin, it was one of those cases that I felt we heard about, we saw the photo, but I really felt no one had really truly done the deep work that needed to be done. Let's get to the heart of the matter. What really transpired that morning in February of 1942?
And by the way, on YouTube, I will be showing these are crystal clear pictures, unlike any that you would see in the newspaper clips. Can you tell the listening audience where you actually got this?
Yes. There might be a couple that they're going to see there. There's some that are slightly darker in nature, and those are actually high-resolution scans off the original negative that is at the Los Angeles Times. And I received that through the cooperation of Ben Hansen. Ben and I were working on a Smithsonian Channel documentary series on UFOs, UFOs Declassified. And they had met with Ben the day prior to coming to my home. And they had actually been at the archives with Simon Elliott, who is the photo archivist at the Los Angeles Times. And what was interesting is while they were filming that segment with Ben, literally the day before they came to my home here in Albuquerque, and this is in the documentary for those that can go look up the episode, while they're filming, Simon Elliott, the archivist, realized something he had never noticed before specific to that negative that you're seeing. And it was that the notch pattern on the side of the negative didn't match or conform to any of the tens of thousands of negatives that are housed there that Simon Elliott is curator for. And each type of film back in that day had a notch code or notch pattern on the side of the negative. It was kind of a brand, if you will, like what we do with cattle, where you could look at that notch code and you would know that's Kodachrome film, blah, blah, blah. It would give you an exact indicator of what type of film was used. And the notch code didn't conform to what all the LA Times photographers used at the time. Simon Elliott states, matter of fact, they all used the same film stock. And on camera, they asked him, well, what does that mean? He said, well, it's suggestive that this photograph was not taken by an LA Times photographer. Now, fast forward 24 hours. Wayne Abbott, the producer and the film crew, come to my home. And when they walk into my research room, not the one we have today, but the research room at the time, I have an original photograph from February 25th, 1942. And on the back of it, and I think it's one of the images you may have there, is the original teletype, the news teletype from February 25th, 1942. And I had an attribution on the frame stating original photograph of the Battle of L.A. And he says, so what you're telling me is this is an original? I said, yes. I said, based on all my research, and I took the photograph out so he could see the stamp indicating property of Associated Press, and he could see the original news teletype. And you could literally see wheels turning in his head. And he goes, I need to show you the film footage we shot just yesterday with Ben and with the archivist at the LA Times. And so with the testimony of Simon Elliott stating that the negative is suggestive, it's not an LA Times photo, and with the one I had showing property of Associated Press, caution, use credit. When we connected the dots, we realized that the famous photograph was probably not taken by an LA Times photographer. Rather, it was taken by an Associated Press photographer. Well, the long story short, how I acquired the photo that I have in my possession, which is hanging up just to my left here, it was acquired on eBay. by an individual selling historic news photos. And again, it's almost like the Blue Book photos. You never know where this material is going to turn up. But I would argue that in collecting this original material, it gives us investigative leads. And case in point, the first question I asked this individual, how in the, you know what, did you obtain this photograph? I'm really curious, especially once I received it and I could see it had all the proper earmarks of an original photo from that time period with the news teletype. And I have other news wire photos from that time for comparison. And I looked at it and he told me, well, Dave, he goes, my wife and I, we live in the greater LA area. So again, he's in that general vicinity where the photo would have been taken. He says, we went to one of many estate sales and yard sales on a Saturday morning. And my wife was looking at some materials. And he goes, this estate sale was not many miles from where we lived. And I was kind of bored and I was just walking around. And my focus was drawn to two large file boxes sitting underneath a folding table sitting in their front yard. And I crouch down and I start going through, very similar to what you see here, just these brown file folders. And he said, as I'm going through it, each individual file had a newswire black and white gloss photo of either a Hollywood celebrity, World War II photo, but it was circa early 40s to about mid late 50s. And on the back of each one was the news teletype. And he goes, I'm going through this. It was like a time capsule. And I asked the young lady that was operating the estate sale, he goes, ma'am, if you don't mind me asking, how did you acquire all these photos? And very innocently enough, she looks at him and says, oh, those belong to my grandfather. He was a photographer for the Associated Press. So this essentially was his portfolio of decades-long photographs he had taken while being an Associated Press photographer. And that wow. led through the efforts of the individual who I bought them from, he assisted me in getting in touch with the family. We found out who the photographer was. So by acquiring really? This original photo, and it's a question, and Martin, you're familiar with the case. It's something that no one really ever asked. Well, who took the famous photo? Who was the photographer? I think that's an element that I've always wanted to find out myself. And so long story short, the name of the photographer, and I'm about 90% certain he's the one that took the famous photo. His name was Ira W. Goldner. And he was a photographer for the Associated Press. In contacting the family, I was able to get family photos of him. So I have pictures or photos of the photographer. I have photos and copies of his photographic credentials, his press passes from all the way from the 1930s up to the 1950s. Wow. And he was a prolific photographer who happened to have a studio in Hollywood, California. And he lived in the greater LA area at the time. And when I started doing research, trying to tie him specifically to the Battle of LA incident, if your audience Googles Ira W. Goldner, you're not going to find many hits on the internet. But what you will find are two photographs from the Associated Press crediting Ira Goldner as a photographer. One is very important, because it shows Japanese citizens being rounded up after the attack on Pearl Harbor. One of them is dated, I believe, February 10th, 1942. And what's important about that, it shows Los Angeles police rounding up Japanese citizens, and he's taking the photo. So it puts him in L.A. in February 1942, just days before the famous Battle of L.A. incident.
Amazing.
So yeah. It's just connecting these dots, you yeah. know, as a researcher and trying to tie all this together. But I would say I'm about 90% certain it was Ira Goldner that was the photographer that took the famous photograph.
It sounds like a lot of fun what you're doing, actually.
I just wish I could do it full time. I mean, you know, we all work full time jobs. There's not many people doing this full time that can actually afford it. But I'm just so excited to be able to delve into these cases. And even Rich Dolan, you know, who published my book, Rich came up to me after, I think, the Battle of L.A. or Farmington incident that I lectured on at a conference we were both at. And he remarked to me, he goes, you know, I think you've really found your niche. He goes, you have the uncanny ability to take a case, a historical UFO case, where we thought we knew all about it, but then you take it to the next level. And so coming from Rich, I take that as a compliment.
Yeah, that's great. I was just thinking, some of the listeners may not really know much about the Battle of LA. Can you kind of go over what actually purportedly happened at the time?
Absolutely. Well, we have to keep in mind, let's set the time period. This was just 2 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Right. So many people, especially the military, were fully anticipating a mainland assault on the California coast. And so just to kind of paint the backdrop, in and around the greater Los Angeles area, extending all the way down the entire southern coast of California, there were any aircraft gun emplacements. There were searchlights that were set up. There were individuals that I had talked to that actually lived there at the time, where they remember leaving their elementary school and seeing gun emplacements set up in and around the city. And so the anticipation was that the Japanese, it wasn't a matter of if they would attack, it was just really a question of when. And so they were poised and ready. And as I say in my lectures, I think really vigilance was the key word, you know, being vigilant in preparation for the Japanese military doing a mainland assault or attempting a mainland assault, because historically they were sweeping across the Pacific, island hopping, you know, continuing to secure island after island, basically pushing towards the east, pushing in our direction. And so that was the backdrop. Again, we weren't thinking UFOs. We weren't thinking aliens. We weren't thinking flying saucers. And as we continue to talk about this case, I'm not saying it was aliens or UFOs, but I do state this case, I believe, is truly a UFO case in the sense it's an unidentified flying object, because when I've examined this case and looked at all the prosaic explanations, none of them seem to fit all of the data. But we'll talk a little bit more about that. But about 36 hours before the incident we're going to talk about, a Japanese submarine had surfaced just off the coast of Santa Barbara and fired a number of deck shells into an area known as the Goleta oil fields. And this was an oil refinery area. And they had attempted to fire and cause some damage. They only caused about $500 in damage. And after the submarine went ahead and went back under the water and headed back out to sea. But 36 hours after this, the entire Southern California area from Los Angeles all the way down was plunged into a blackout. Now, skeptics always like to attack this case and, you know, remark at the folly of UFO researchers and believers for calling this UFO case. One thing they never talk about, and I emphasize this in my lectures, one thing they never address is why did this blackout occur and why did this UFO sighting happen? Well, what precipitated everything regarding the Battle of LA is something that the skeptics never talk about, and that's namely a solitary radar target that was tracked by three separate radar systems. We had two SCR-270 long-range radars that were tracking an inbound radar target for 120 miles moving inbound towards the California coast. It was also picked up by an SCR-268, which was the first radar used by the United States Army. There, three radar systems are tracking this object. And by the way, all of this information is based on the government documents secured through the research of Barry Greenwood. So just for anybody that would like to know where the source of this information is coming from, and I can make that available to anybody that's interested in seeing the documents. But they track this target for 120 miles, a solitary radar target. And I emphasize that for a reason as we get into talking about some other aspects of this case. The object dropped off radar minutes before an object was sighted starting to move inland off the west coast and from Malibu, essentially, in Santa Monica. It starts moving in over Culver City, which is where we believe the famous photograph was snapped. The object moves inland. It then drops down south towards Long Beach and disappears. Now, I'm giving the Reader's Digest version. There's a lot more to the story. But as this object is slowly moving around, and by the way, all the news accounts and military reports state it was moving too slow to be an aircraft. So let's keep that in mind. Witnesses never described hearing airplanes. People saw many different things that night. But I like to emphasize that this solitary target moved around. The searchlights tracked it. And I believe what you see in the famous photograph there is essentially what is described in the radio broadcasts and the newspaper accounts, that as the object moved, it was tracked by the searchlights, and any aircraft fire was thrown up at it. And as your viewers will see on the famous photo, there's all these little white dots around the central object. Those are actually anti-aircraft explosions caught at the split second the photographer snapped the photograph. So you can count how many little explosions are around it. That was just a split second. We can only imagine how many explosions peppered around this object. And in fact, over 1,440 rounds of 3-inch shells were expended at that object, in addition to 50 caliber rounds and 37 millimeter rounds. And this is, again, based on government documents from the time period. The object disappeared, though, unscathed, apparently, off the coast of Long Beach. 20 minutes after the firing died down, the object returned in essentially reversed direction and moved closer to the LA area. And again, much like my Farmington research, this is all based on correlating the government documents with the original newspapers, of which I have about 15 original front page newspapers from the time period, in addition to those that have been microfilmed, and correlating it with the CBS radio news broadcast from that morning. And so trying to synthesize all of these things together. And the object, like I said, reversed direction and disappeared off the coast of Santa Monica from roughly the direction it came from. And so we have radar of a solitary object confirmation. We have a photograph of a solitary object. And based on the CBS radio news broadcast, they talk about a solitary object, not multiple objects. And again, for one of the images you may be showing to the audience, the news teletype that I have the original of references a solitary target, mystery target, as it's often alluded to, or mystery object. And so I use that as kind of my rationale for approaching the Battle of LA case as looking at one solitary unidentified flying object. There were many different reports. People reported seeing V formations of fighter planes, V formations of bombers, miscellaneous objects flitting about the sky. But I try to be conservative in my investigation and try to base it not so much on the eyewitness testimony, but on things that we can analyze or reference that are more objective in nature, namely the photograph and the radar target. So that's kind of a synopsis. And then there's been, unfortunately, like a lot of cases, Martin, a lot that has been done in the way of damage by UFO researchers and conspiracy theorists, because what I just relayed are the facts as we know them, based on the newspapers, government documents, eyewitness accounts. Later in years, people state, well, the object was shot down and this UFO was recovered by military, and that was the beginning of the UFO cover-up. There's absolutely no verifiable factual information to support that. That's where people, unfortunately, have taken good cases and debased them by blending all of this minutia into it. A lot of spurious material. An IPU, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, was referenced, which actually was a military unit, as verified by researchers in the 70s and the 80s. But apparently it was just a think tank that existed for a very short period of time and never was a functioning or active military unit as such. But then spurious documents came forward, much like the MJ-12 documents, documents that we simply can't verify. Even the best researchers have to admit they can't 100% verify the authenticity of these documents. And if I can't verify the authenticity, if I can't show the provenance, I'm not going to quote those documents. Right. And I think we need to be very careful when we do historical research in that sense.
Now, you're talking about your research. What about investigations, contemporary investigations of what was happening?
With regard to the Battle of LA?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, military authorities were obviously trying to figure out what was going on at the time. And this went all the way, not from just the general public and the military, Congress. When you look at the news reports from the time, it was, I believe, State Representative Leland of California was demanding Congress do an investigation, because, as you can imagine, this created pandemonium. There were about 6 to 7 people that died that night due to heart attacks and vehicular accidents. They were trying to drive during the blackout and would run into something or run into another individual. And so people died as a result of this. And again, the skeptics laugh at this case, but I always like to point out people lost their lives that night, regardless of your take on what really happened. I mean, people lost their lives as a result. And what's interesting about it, though, is Leland was demanding Congress investigate the case. The military at the time, the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, said it was just all jittery war nerves. Secretary of War Stimson said, no, there really were planes or there really were mystery objects in the sky. And so you had two conflicting explanations that the public was being given at the time. And one of the famous documents on the Battle of L.A. is a briefing document that was sent to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because, as I say, interest went all the way to the top. Yeah, as you can imagine, the president wanted to know what happened. And especially when you have military, ordnance being expended and thrown into the air over a populated city like Los Angeles. What's interesting, though, is despite the, I guess you could say, short-lived interest on the part of the government, military authorities, these two conflicting explanations were never resolved. And again, we have to put ourselves back in February 1942 and March 1942, the subsequent month. We were still engaged in World War II. I mean, in fact, we were just getting into World War II. So, we didn't have time to just ponder this one little episode, in time. And what's interesting is after the ensuing interest right after the event, interest disappeared. The war continued and life went on. And in fact, it wasn't until the 1960s where Kenneth Larson wrote an article in a Flying Saucer periodical published by Max Miller. It was Flying Saucers Pictorial, and it showed the famous photo from the Battle of L.A. And it was really that magazine article that rekindled it, not just on the point of UFO enthusiasts, but historians. It had kind of been forgotten for the most part. In fact, I lecture on the case today, and I'll have like World War II buffs say, I never even knew about this case. I never even knew about this episode. And what's interesting about that is right after Kenneth Larson's article, which didn't go in depth, unfortunately, very much, but it resurfaced, it rekindled that interest on the case. It was actually Gordon Lohr and Harold Deneau with NICAP that wrote a fairly detailed account in their book, Mysteries of the Skies, that was published in the 60s. And that did a little bit more in depth. They actually looked at some of the newspaper accounts from the time period. But again, credit where credit's due. It really wasn't until the late 70s, early 80s, where Barry Greenwood obtained the official military documents that really started to give us additional insights into the case. So it was really a succession of researchers and enthusiasts that started bringing more information to light. And of course, it is an untouched, undoctored photograph. And there's always been a lot of, like I said, misinformation on this case. The famous photo that most people will see when they go on the internet is a doctored, touched up photo. And I don't mean anything nefarious, but back then they used to paint on the original photographs or negatives. They used to actually doctor the image so it would translate better into newsprint. There was no government conspiracy by any means. And the famous one that people see has been doctored and touched up. The one that they're hopefully seeing while we're discussing the case is an undoctored photo. And what you really see on that dispels a misconception with regard to whatever was captured in the convergence of those searchlights in the photograph. And a lot of people historically have said, well, we see a beautiful flying saucer with a little cupola or dome on top.
Yeah.
But that is the doctored image. That is the enhanced image, which you, from an evidentiary standpoint, you might as well throw it in the trash bin. You really can't use that. In the midst of that is this elliptical gray object that definitely stands out. You see a difference in the contrast ratio there between those, the conglomeration of little white blobs. And I don't know, Martin, if you can see that as I'm describing it there. But it definitely paints a different picture of what people have traditionally seen in that photograph.
Excellent. So now you mentioned earlier there were about over 1,400 three-inch rounds shot at this thing. I would only guess that the thing must have been hit. I mean, what are the observations about that?
Well, some witnesses state that the object had apparently sustained direct hits. The Byron Palmer, the CBS radio broadcaster in the famous radio broadcast, states shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit it. But I think the rationale there was because it didn't come down. That if it was a plane, we would have brought it down. If it was a balloon, it would have deflated. It would have come down. So I think that was more of an inference based on the fact that the object apparently seemed unscathed, that it must not have sustained any direct hits. But what's interesting about that is I have wrestled with the idea trying to find a practical explanation. And a lot of the skeptics will say it was a meteorological balloon or it was a barrage balloon that became untethered. From a visual standpoint, I will concede that that elliptical shape that appears in the undoctored negative could conform to a barrage balloon that became untethered. They're elliptical. They were manufactured by the Shell Corporation. It was a cotton fabric that was basically encased in a latex rubber material that was then painted silver. So it would have been light reflective as well. But when you look at the radar data, when you look at the way that this object maneuvered, not once but twice over the greater LA area, when it apparently could stop at times and then move slowly, when it could execute turns, apparently under some guided or intelligent control, I, despite my best efforts, cannot resolve myself to explaining it away as a untethered barrage balloon. And this is the thing also. We have investigative notes. We have meeting notes that were conducted by military officials that were in charge of the defense of the Western coast, where they're trying to explain it away and trying to rationalize it. The simplest, easiest thing that you would see in one of these government documents or in these meeting notes is that we found a deflated, large, untethered anti-aircraft barrage balloon that was draped over a roof. And there's your answer, case closed. But they don't have that. They never offered that as an explanation. And in fact, it was, I believe, in 1949 in an obscure anti-aircraft journal magazine that a writer stated that definitively the Battle of LA had been attributed to not one but two meteorological balloons that had broken loose or that had been sighted by anti-aircraft gun batteries and were fired on. What's interesting is they never reference a document where they're coming up with that. And when you look at the contemporaneous notes by military officials and the meeting notes from the time period, and I'm talking top brass, generals in D.C. as well as the Western coast, they never reference that as a definitive explanation. What was interesting is when you look at it, and again, we have to go back to the thinking in 1942. The thinking in the notes, and I'm paraphrasing, was something like this. The fact that the object moved too slow to be an aircraft must suggest that it might have been a balloon. But of course, now, after 1947, and after we began to look at this UFO subject, we can now look back and think, well, is there a third explanation? Is there something that moves too slow to be an aircraft that could sustain direct or near direct hits by any aircraft fire that happens to be elliptical in shape and that can move intelligently, yet not conform to the physical description of an aircraft? And in point of fact, looking at the conventional explanations, the Japanese military at the conclusion of World War II categorically denied any military operations on February 25th, 1942, near or over the Los Angeles area. They categorically denied that. That's officially on record. We have newspapers that testify that, official statements by Japanese spokesmen. The other thing we have to factor in is people said, well, maybe it was military aircraft, our military aircraft. One of the interesting things, despite the fact many witnesses thought they saw aircraft in the air that night, all of our fighter planes were on the ground. Hmm. And we have an official government declassified memorandum between two generals where the topic of aircraft was brought up. And it states, we only had 45 aircraft, which is really scary when you think back to it, only 45 military aircraft defending the West Coast at that time.
Amazing.
And it states, aircraft were on the ground, the pilots were in their cockpits, the planes were fueled and ready, but they did not want to launch the planes because, again, they reference a solitary mystery object. They stated, we did not want to send our 45 planes up if this object was a reconnaissance plane that was a prelude for the main attack. which makes sense. It makes perfect military sense. And so, and especially the fact that no bombs were dropped, no damage was sustained as a result of the, this mysterious object. But in the military's defense, they had planes ready. It wasn't that they were completely impotent with regard to this whole episode, but they stated, we did not want to have our planes up in the air, half out of fuel, when the main attack, which they thought was impending, was going to actually manifest itself.
Now, one last question on this case. Had there been, since that time, had there been anything similar to that happen over L.A.?
They had a blackout in December, which is interesting. I have the original. Again, this is one of those I secured the original newspaper of. And, you know, people say, well, the Californians, they were just thrown into a panic because of this this blackout. And they their imaginations ran wild with them. One of the things, one of the reasons I bought that newspaper was this fact. December 7th, 1941, right? Pearl Harbor. The first blackout that occurred in Los Angeles was literally just days after Pearl Harbor. If people were going to be panicked, if there was going to be a state of hysteria, I would think it would be in the intervening or subsequent days right after Pearl Harbor, not 2 months, not two full months after the events of Pearl Harbor. And yet we have a blackout where no one died. There were no anti-aircraft guns that shelled or pumped metal and shrapnel into the air. Everything was fine. Californians behaved themselves perfectly. It wasn't until February 25th, 1942, with this radar confirmation that again triggered this entire blackout, where guns were in operation and they were firing at something. So I use that as a point of contrast historically when we're looking at these two episodes. People weren't in a panic just days after Pearl Harbor. So why would they be in this hysteria 2 months later?
Right.
I just throw that out to my audiences to think about.
Yeah. Well, I think you've done great work on that case. It's an amazing thing, and it's one of those unknowns.
And that's just it. At the end of my lectures, Martin, when I talk about this case, I always state, this is the information that I've gathered, and I systematically rule out all the prosaic explanations. If you're in agreement with my logic and how I go through and systematically explain all these away, then we're left with a genuine unknown. You fill in the blank. And I state matter-of-factly, I'm not saying it's extraterrestrial, but all I'm saying is it's an unknown aerial object that to this day, 75 plus years later, we're still trying to figure it out. But it's an interesting case. It's an interesting chapter in World War II history, you know, at the very least. And I find it interesting. In fact, UNM, they were very interested. They used the Battle of LA photo as part of their poster promoting my lecture for the university, which I thought was interesting. And even the dean was very interested in the case itself. And when I go out and lecture, people are very, very captivated by it. When I do my lectures a lot, I'll bring the original newspapers, framed newspapers, so people can see it. Because I think when you talk about historic cases or history, sometimes people get a little bit of a yawn, you know, oh, that happened years ago. When they can see the real photograph, the real news teletype, the real newspapers, it makes it more real. It really conveys that, no, this was really an episode in history, and here's some of the historical artifacts from that time period.
Now, right now, we're not leaving the same type of footprint as all your library is and everything that you're collecting. And, you know, I think about that, too, as well as, you know, I'm an appraiser of documents and things. So
absolutely.
Yeah. And I know an email, by the way, Bill Clinton's email to an astronaut sold for $20,000 at an auction.
Oh, my goodness.
It's the only digital thing that I've found records on.
Based on your line of work, and I think that's why you appreciate a lot of my research, it's all about the provenance.
Yes, absolutely.
It's when you're talking photographs, when you're talking newspapers, it's when you go to the originals. I mean, they may have gotten some details wrong here or there, but you can't question the source of the material when you're looking at a 75-year-old newspaper, or you're looking at the original news teletype affixed to the back of an original photograph stamped Associated Press and dated February 25th, 1942. That's what I love to do. One, I'm a collector in addition to a historian. I don't think you can be one without the other to some extent. But I think it's important, and I think you'll agree, that it is about the provenance of information. And to your point, with some of today's UFO researchers, I think they do a disservice to themselves and to their audiences when they put forth material that they can't verify, that they haven't even attempted to properly vet. And, you know, I try to be honest with myself as well as my audiences in providing factually verifiable information and not going down the rabbit hole of spurious materials and purported government documents and purported government conspiracies. I think it titillates the imagination, but I'm not interested in imagination. I'm interested in facts. And the facts are so much more interesting, in my opinion.
That's one of the things I really, really like about you and why I enjoy you as a guest. And just to let the listening audience know, prior to this show, I asked Dave to send me an image of what he thought was the best triangle UFO. And his answer was, I'm not into the pictures. I'm into basically the witness testimony and following the facts. I think that kind of speaks to you know what you do. And
well, thank you.
And just
to clarify that, the only reason we're talking about the Battle of LA photo is because we have verifiable source documents. We have the news teletype. We have the earmarks that this is from official news agencies. Today, unfortunately, with the digital technology, the videos that you see on YouTube, the photographs that people are posting can easily be digitally manipulated. And I'm not a photographic expert or analyst. I will leave photographs and that to those individuals. The only reason I reference the Battle of LA photo is because we do know the official source through which it came from. And so it didn't come from just some anonymous source that we can't verify.
Yeah. So I think this would be a good segue to talk about triangle UFOs, what sure. Most people know you by your wonderful book out there.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
So, okay. So you wrote the book, you talked about it a lot, very successful sales, and everybody talks about your book. And what's the exact title of that?
Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation. That's which right. is actually military parlance. Yeah. I use that because that was, of course, the famous estimate of the situation that the Air Force drafted a document, you know, in 1948 on that. And it's kind of become mythical in nature. But anytime the military does a report, it usually has the attribution or the subtitle, An Estimate of the Situation, whether it's an aircraft accident. But I thought it was appropriate because I tried to approach, as you know, writing the book as like a military analyst. If I was an intelligence analyst and I was given this information, how would I collate the material? How would I synthesize it into essentially an intelligence briefing document, if you will? And towards the end, I drafted as that when I started putting my summary together. And I was really fascinated with the history, and that's why I wrote the book. Again, getting back to history, I sound like a broken record, but it's my passion. But really one of the reasons I wrote it was I was seeing people posting just comments that were completely erroneous when you look at the facts. People stating, well, these triangular UFOs must be military because they only started being seen in the 70s and 80s when stealth technology came out. And I'm sitting in my research room and I have just tons of original news clippings, newspapers, copies of military documents referencing large triangular silent UFOs. In fact, one of the famous ones, which you may remember from the book and some of your audience if they've read the book, in November 1957, the Danish Defense Intelligence Service had a wave of triangular UFOs, which at that time, I always like to say, this is their term, not mine, it was referenced as triangular spaceships. Mm-hmm. And I verified that finding an old Reuters News Service article from spring of 1958, in which the apparent wave of sightings was still continuing. And the Reuters News Service stated they interviewed a woman in the village of Brohure who had witnessed a large, silent, hovering, triangular object, just like the modern day reports, that not only was observed hovering over the village, but horseshoe-shaped UFOs seen shooting out of this object. Now, what's interesting about that is it's through Reuters. Reuters in the article itself states they were able to talk to at least 20 other villagers that basically agreed with the woman's testimony, They had corroborative testimony stating they had seen the same thing. But this was in 1957, reports of triangular objects, and more importantly, being investigated by the Danish military. So, and what's interesting is the same week that that wave apparently started, based on my research, we have two accounts in Blue Book, actually three accounts, two case files describing triangular UFOs with lights at each point moving silently in low altitude. One was over, I believe, Delavan, Wisconsin, and the other one across the Illinois border. And in an air intelligence report from the same week, we have in Sumatra, Indonesia, two fishermen that claim they saw this triangular object moving over their fishing boat, all within the same week in 1957.
That's amazing.
And this is before the days of the internet, where you can quickly see what's going on across the world and then fabricate a report. This was all within a matter of days that these were all being reported across the world. And then that's just, of course, one of many. Blue Book, in fact, Project Blue Book, I went through all the Blue Book files and tried to cull all of the triangular reports they had. What was interesting is there was a case from the mid-60s, and there was a sketch, which I included in my book, where they show the triangle like this, but the flat side is the leading edge. In other words, the object was moving like this. Mm-hmm. And that conforms to some of the modern day accounts where witnesses state, I saw this triangular object, but it was strange. The point of the object wasn't the leading edge like we would think of with aircraft. And here in the mid 60s, we have a report in Blue Book where they show an equilateral triangle moving with a blunt side forward with three bright white lights at each point, which conforms to the modern day reports. And then in Flying Saucer Review magazine, going back even further, in the late 50s, there was a gentleman that was a researcher that actually wrote an article on Delta Volants, as he called him, or Flying Deltas. And that's what they called them back then in England. And interestingly enough, one of the characteristics he pointed out in the article was the uncanny strange ability for these triangular objects to move with the flat side as the leading edge. So when you start to see conformity in these reports, you have to stand up and start taking notice and realizing that there is a pattern of reporting. And the one thing I think is important, again, going back to the thinking of the time, Martin, if you or I were sitting in a cornfield in 1952 looking up at the stars and we decided we were going to invent a flying saucer story, we're probably going to invent a story that conforms to what people want to hear, namely a flying saucer. Mm-hmm. These people weren't reporting that. They were reporting something that completely went against the grain. So if you wanted to come up with a believable hoax or a fabricated story, you think you would tell the people what they want to hear. Oh, yeah, I saw a flying saucer with a little dome on top. That's not what these people were reporting.
So what do you tell the – well, I have a couple of questions about this, about your book too and how that led to other things. But what – do you tell the – I've had skeptics on the show that have said this phrase to me, and that is all of triangle UFOs are – and I had someone actually say this verbatim. All triangle UFOs are basically secret government craft.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your response? Because you said back in 1957, I don't think they would have something like that.
And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to show the historical argument, because usually that thought process is predicated on the notion I alluded to earlier, that these things didn't appear until the 70s or the 80s. And it, you know what? If they only did appear then, I would probably be saying, yeah, this has to be something military because we didn't see them before. The historical record simply doesn't bear that out. We see reports worldwide describing similar objects, similar flight dynamics, and I won't answer that question. If I can kind of channel, if you will, statements made by the late Dr. Paul Ziss. Dr. Ziss worked at St. Louis University. He was in charge of Parks Air College, teaching aerospace and aviation. And he was a leading aviation authority. Anytime a plane crashed or a new plane came out, they would always interview Dr. Paul Ziss. I had, luckily, the ability to interview him. In fact, I have one regret with the book, which I often don't talk about. I actually had half a chapter I was going to devote to having Dr. Ziss talk about where state-of-the-art technology is, as far as he could talk about it, because he was involved in compartmentalized classified projects. When I got in touch with him, he was battling cancer and actually died about, I believe it was August, just 2 months after my book was published. Mm-hmm. But I did get the ability to interview him by phone, and I was able to get one thing, which he said I could quote him on. And I asked him this, going back to the famous January 5th, 2000 case, which I personally investigated, which really personally ushered me into looking at these triangular UFOs. I asked him, because he was interviewed at the time by St. Louis media in the wake of that sighting, wanting to get his aviation expert opinion on this. And I asked him, I said, knowing about that case, because I know you had a personal interest in it, and based on your 30 plus years of research in compartmentalized classified projects, and his specialty for Boeing and McDonnell Douglas was advanced aviation propulsion technology. I mean, that was his specialty. So I defer to him as an expert. I asked him, I said, looking back on this case 13 years later, knowing what you know about that case and knowing about what you know of as being state-of-the-art technology, do you think these police officers saw something we manufactured, or do you think it was someone else's technology? And he stated, David, if they were only describing a triangular aircraft, I would think it could have been something that you might see near Edwards Air Force Base, which was his way of implying that we do have triangular shaped aircraft. But he went on to state the ability for this object to accelerate from a dead stop, to go supersonic, to not generate a sonic boom, and to basically have some of these other unusual flight characteristics. He said, I believe it was someone else's technology. I'm paraphrasing. People can look at it in the book, the exact quote. But I defer to him. My opinion doesn't matter, but here's a gentleman, 30 years of compartmentalized classified projects in the area of advanced aviation propulsion. I think his opinion carries some weight. And he doesn't think what these things people have been seeing, he doesn't think that these are ours.
Wow, interesting. We only have a couple minutes left. Can you believe it?
Time flies every time we talk.
I know it does. I know that you were, after your book was out, that you were contacted by many, many other people that wanted to tell you about their triangle cases. Is there going to be a volume two?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me that. And first, let me just say, I was naive. I had never written a book before. And like I said, I wanted to set the record straight. I wanted to get these people that were making these comments that simply didn't match the information that I was sitting in front of. My goal was to get the information out there, to set the record straight, and basically encourage other people. Look, this is what I found in the way of research. I hope this will encourage you to do additional research. What I did not expect, and I'm still to this day periodically getting emails and phone calls from people, reports from all around the world. I mean, Martin, I have to tell you, I was humbled by receiving emails from people in Switzerland, Germany, the UK. Many of these people I then subsequently interviewed, and getting these reports. And I even, one of the first ladies that contacted me, it started with a series of emails, and then I wanted to speak with her. She had a sighting in the mid-80s up around New York, and I believe it was right before around the Hudson Valley time period. I talked to her, and she literally was in tears talking to me, and this is why. She said, David, for years I would tell people about my UFO sighting, and I wasn't the only one that saw it. But even friends and family would kind of give me that look like, come on, really, did you see that? And she goes, I know what I saw. She goes, I know I saw something. But she goes, and then some of my friends that would just kind of ridicule it or laugh it off. And she told me, and she's like I said, she was in tears. She said, your book gave validity to my sighting. She goes, you validated what I know I saw. And when I read about other people having these sightings, it validated everything that I knew. But I tried to tell these other people, and I've had a number of other people use that term, that you validated my sighting.
Wow.
And I want to thank the people that have come forward and reached out to me and shared their cases and their reports with me. Will I write a second book on the subject? At this point, I would say no, only because the one issue I ran into in writing the book was not trying to be too redundant, but at the same time trying to impart the fact that there is consistency. I wanted to be redundant to the point where, look, isn't it interesting that these reports are redundant, that these disparate witnesses are reporting the same thing. I think I've made my case. I think I've established enough case material to show that there is a pattern, there is a profile. And I think to go any further with that would truly be redundant with a capital R. What I really want to start focusing on, though, are these historical cases, as we alluded to in the show today, the Farmington incident, the Battle of L.A., and there's some other historical cases that I'm just waiting for the free time to delve into. So I think I've done enough for triangular UFOs, and at the risk of getting stereotyped, in fact, people that have talked to me, they're like, well, I thought you just did triangular UFOs. I said, well, don't stereotype me. I feel like an actor from the 60s. You know, I did that one show back in the 60s. Now people only see me for that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of material here and a lot of material I still have to go through. And that's where I really want to kind of dig my teeth into and continue that historical investigation of cases.
Dave, you've been wonderful as always. So glad to talk to you.
I always have fun, either on air or off air with our conversation. So this has been really enjoyable, and really appreciated David O'Leary as well at the beginning of the show. That was a treat.
Excellent. All right. Well, you take care.
You too, my friend.
All right. All right, everyone. So that's it. We'll be back next week. And actually, for those listening on YouTube, we're going to be back in just a couple of days on Tuesday. And we're going to be in studio with Mac Maloney and friends. All right, everyone, thanks so much. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.
And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes, and he said, we're not alone.